Well, it's my pleasure to be here. I am from Madison originally, and then left, got my doctorate at University of California, Berkeley, so I was familiar with a lot of the things that Sherry was saying, a lot of the news from California. I graduated from Madison West High School, not far from here, so I'm delighted to be back to participate in this exciting event, and I brought my parents along as well, who live here in Madison, and they're the proud owners of a 2004 Toyota Prius. In fact, I'd like to think that I had something to do with their purchase of a hybrid, and I have a short story to share with you regarding that. Not long after my parents purchased the Toyota Prius, my dad found himself stranded on the side of the road. The Prius had ceased to run, and I could imagine how he was cursing his son for suggesting that he purchase this newfangled machinery, and it turned out what happened is he ran out of gas. So the danger to hybrid owners is that you fuel up so seldomly that sometimes you forget to fuel up at all. I've given a few different versions of this talk, mostly to groups of engineers, and my wife asked me if I was going to make this talk a little less technical in nature for the audience, but I said, on the contrary, hybrid owners and enthusiasts are some of the most sophisticated people from a technology standpoint that I know. So you can trust me when I say that I haven't watered down this speech at all. What I'm going to talk about today is well-to-wheel emissions from motor vehicles, and what I'm going to focus on is, first talk about the air pollutant emissions that are a concern and what regulatory developments have come about in the last year or so, and what challenges do these regulations and emissions present to the automotive industry, and then what's driving the development of alternatives to the internal combustion engine to drive our motor vehicles. I'll talk about a well-to-wheel perspective. Sherry talked a bit about this. I'll deal with this in a little bit more detail, and I'll compare the well-to-wheel efficiency for some of the different alternatives, and I'll also compare the well-to-wheel carbon dioxide emissions from some of the different alternatives. And then I'll take a closer look. We heard a lot about the plug-in hybrid in the last talk. I'll take a closer look at the plug-in hybrid and look at some of the driving economics. And finally, I'll get out my crystal ball and predict what is the motor vehicle passenger fleet going to look like in the year 2020. So the pollutants that we're concerned with, first, hydrocarbon emissions from our motor vehicles. It's a precursor to photochemical smog and also a precursor to organic aerosols, which can be dangerous to our health. NOx from an engine is emitted as nitric oxide. In the atmosphere, it's oxidized to nitrogen dioxide, which is a respiratory irritant, and that's also a precursor to ground-level ozone. And ground-level ozone is the principal component of photochemical smog. It's a strong respiratory irritant, and it's the of greatest concern of any toxic pollutant, because the greatest number of people in the world who live in unhealthy air are living in unhealthy air because of high ground-level ozone levels. We're concerned with particulate matter from motor vehicles that's linked to multiple adverse health effects, including lung cancer, childhood asthma, acute mortality. And we all know that carbon dioxide is implicated in global climate change and is therefore should be considered a pollutant. The Supreme Court just ruled this spring that EPA can regulate it as a pollutant. What the current challenges are for the automotive industry really are the NOx emissions and the carbon dioxide emissions. The U.S. EPA and the European Union have promulgated new standards in the U.S. They're called the BIN 5 Tier 2 standards, and the Euro 6 standards will go into effect shortly. And the Euro 6 standard is a 68% reduction in NOx over the current levels. So that presents a real challenge for not the the spark ignition engines, but for diesel engines. Diesel engines have higher combustion temperatures, which leads to greater NOx formation. And California has proposed new CO2 tailpipe emission standards, as well as the European Union and Japan. And to meet these standards, the real challenge is going to be able to do it in a cost-effective manner, because you have to control costs so that you can get the technology into the marketplace where it can have the greatest impact. So to give you an example, a U.S. automaker has stated that to meet the stringent NOx standards that are going into that will go into effect, it'll require an extra $5,000 on a diesel engine. And so that's a really significant cost challenge that they're gonna have to meet. And in this country, we don't have a lot of passenger diesel vehicles on the road. But I would consider that an alternative to a spark ignition internal combustion engine as we go forward. So a lot has been happening in the CO2 regulation area. California has a tailpipe standard that will be a 22% decrease by 2009 and a 50% reduction by 2016. They also have come out with a low-carbon fuel standard, and this is all part of a greater strategy to cut greenhouse gas emissions in the whole state to 1990 levels by 2020. And so that's a 25% reduction overall. And Governor Schwarzenegger is pushing a cap-and-trade approach. So you cap the level of CO2 emissions and allow the marketplace to work, which then meets the it finds the most efficient solution. And it's been used to regulate sulfur dioxide emissions from power plants, and it was very effective in that regard. California is waiting for a waiver from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and they've been waiting for quite a while, and I doubt it's going to come in the current administration. It might take a change of administration for them to finally get the waiver and start to be able to regulate carbon dioxide emissions. The New York Times called California the petri dish of carbon regulations, and I'd say that's an apt description. We're all looking at California, seeing what's going to happen there, and I think they're going to be hard-pressed to implement these regulations, particularly since at the beginning of this month, Governor Schwarzenegger terminated his the chairman of the California Air Resources Board. So he replaced the California Air Resources Board chairman with and installed a politico. The person he dismissed, his name's Robert Sawyer. He happened to be my graduate school advisor at Berkeley, and he's one of the most respected air quality scientists in the world, and he installed a person who has a background in law to head that agency. So we have an organization that is supposed to be instituting the regulations based on science, but it's being headed up by a political person. So that's really tragic news for the whole country, and indeed the world, as the California Air Resources Board is the most important air regulatory board in the world. Oops, there we go. What's been happening on the federal level? Well, are we going to have new federal corporate average fuel economy standards? In the Senate version of the energy bill, there were new standards. They're going to push up the standard to 35 miles per gallon by the year 2020, and that would include not only light-duty motor vehicles, but also SUVs. But in the House, by the end of the month, they're going to probably come out with their new energy bill. And you know what the problem is there? It's the Dinglesaurus. Representative Dingell from Michigan is standing in the way of new CAFE standards because he's trying to protect the auto industry. And so we'll see how Nancy Pelosi deals with that, and she'll probably bring it up as an amendment to the bill and have it voted on. So we may see new CAFE standards by the end of the year. There is, and Sherry mentioned the plug-in hybrid tax credit, $4,000 to $6,000 tax credit, which the House of Representatives is proposing. I mentioned the Euro and Japan regulations So the European Union and Japan both have regulations that are very similar to the California Air Resources Board standards. Bush administration has announced their goals to decrease tailpipe CO2 by 10% by 2017, as well as decreasing gas consumption by 20% by 2017. So they're going to decrease gas consumption by trying to use more biofuels. And you, so you compare that to the California standard. California is looking at a 50% reduction by 2016, Bush administration 10% by 2017. So that's an interesting note. What's really exciting is I mentioned the spring Supreme Court decision that opens the door for the federal carbon regulation, and two bills are in the works. In the House of Representatives, the Safe Climate Act of 2007, that would adopt the California standards nationwide. The Global Warming Pollution Act, Reduction Act in the Senate is also, it has CO2 tailpipe emission standards very similar to California. So you can see, you can imagine what's going to happen, though, when these bills are debated, and if they are, they're passed through the House and the Senate and through conference committee, when they land on President Bush's desk, what do you think is going to happen? He's saying 10% by 2017. He's not going to accept 50% by 2016. So it's going to be a veto, and we'll see what happens after that. But we see that after decades of inaction, that the federal government is at least addressing the issue. What is getting the ball rolling here? Well, what's driving this push for alternatives is we could all agree that we've become too dependent on foreign oil, and the quagmire in Iraq is a daily reminder of that. And also, we can now all agree that CO2 emissions are troublesome and due to their impact on climate. So what can we do to decrease CO2 emissions from a motor vehicle? Well, you can do two things. If you're burning a hydrocarbon fuel, like gasoline, the only way you can decrease CO2 emissions is by improving the efficiency of the vehicle. What else can you do? Well, you can go to alternative fuels, like biofuels that are renewable, like electric vehicles or plug-in hybrids that are operating on electric energy that may be generated from renewables or from nuclear. Or you can go to fuel cells using hydrogen. Of course, hydrogen isn't a source of energy on this planet. It's just a way to store energy. Okay, I'll talk more about that in a minute. Here's an interesting fact. In the U.S., we consume, on average, 1.3 gallons of gasoline per person per day. If the rest of the world consumed at that rate, world consumption would go up by a factor of 10. And what does the rest of the world want to do? They want to live like us. They want our standard of living. So they aspire to live like us. And you see, if they consume gasoline like we do, not only is there going to lead to huge shortages and price spikes, but also the climate change implications would be astounding. So that's something to consider. I mentioned the void of leadership in Washington over the past few years on both sides of the aisle in this regard. In that void, businesses have stepped in and have started dealing with carbon dioxide emissions. There's the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. These are large companies, profitable companies, and I've listed some of them there, and their goal is to reduce their CO2 emissions. There's also the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, and you see there's some unlikely, what you might consider unlikely names in that list, companies that are partnering with the National Resources Defense Council, the Pew Center on Climate Change, and they're lobbying lawmakers in Washington for a cap-and-trade approach for carbon dioxide emissions. So what we're finding is that some businesses are really stepping forward and taking a leadership role in this carbon dioxide problem. The GE chairman recently said, green is good for business. And many of you probably are aware of the Rocky Mountain Institute, led by Amory Lovins in Colorado. And Amory Lovins has been saying this for ages, and he has shown businesses that conservation is good for your bottom line. You shouldn't do it because it's the right thing to do. You should do it because it's going to save you money. And why would these businesses be so concerned with getting some kind of carbon regulation in the works? Well, they don't like the uncertainty. Okay, as a business person, you don't like to live in a regulatory environment that's uncertain. If they think carbon regulation is going to come along eventually, they'd rather have it now, and then they can deal with it and do it in a way that the marketplace work have a cap and trade framework. So this is also an opportunity for our country in terms of the economy. This advanced energy technologies, what people call clean tech, could be the next locomotive to drive our economy for the coming decades, in a similar fashion that the high-tech revolution drove our economy. And this is really an opportunity that some of these companies aren't going to want to miss. Well, what about the old internal combustion engine? Is the internal combustion engine going to go away? I'm a mechanical engineer, so I'm very fond of the internal combustion engine. And I'm glad to tell you that it's not going to go away. In these hybrid vehicles, you still have an internal combustion engine. If you're burning biofuels, you're still burning them in an internal combustion engine. So these internal combustion engines will be around. And I'd say that it's perhaps the most important technological development in history. A computer scientist or an electrical engineer might disagree with me. Computer's pretty important as well. But we have 200 million motor vehicles in the U.S. powered by IC engines. And this has very significant impacts for the environment, for our energy security, for our national security. The transportation sector accounts for about 30% of our energy use, and 98% of that energy comes from petroleum. And guess what? We import 60% of our petroleum. So yes, this has our dependence on petroleum to drive our motor vehicles has vast implications. Well, there have been advances in internal combustion engine technology through the years. We've seen an improvement of about 1-2% per year, but it's been masked by our desire to drive more powerful and larger vehicles. So we haven't seen it. And again, because the corporate average fuel economy standards haven't changed since in almost two decades. What are some of the things you can do? Well, I won't get into this too much, but turbocharging, supercharging, direct injection, displacement on demand. If you're interested in any of these technologies, I'd be happy to talk about them later. But the bottom line is that there are technologies to reduce consumption. For instance, VW has a twin charger engine. It's a small engine, 1.4 liters, but it develops 168 horsepower. So that's a lot of horsepower per liter. It gets 40 miles per gallon on the highway and 33 miles per gallon overall. And 168 horsepower engine. So that's just using supercharging and turbocharging technology. What are some of the alternatives then to the spark ignition, spark internal combustion engine? Well, diesel engines, as I said, we don't use diesels in the passenger vehicle fleet here, so that's an alternative. Gasoline electric hybrids, that's what this is all about, Hybrid Fest. The issue there is a cost premium, so those costs need to be brought down. Electric vehicles, fuel cell vehicles, biofuel vehicles, and plug-in hybrids, these are all alternatives, and I'll talk about their efficiency as well as their well-to-wheel CO2 emissions. So Sherry introduced this idea of well-to-wheel efficiency. Basically, you have to look at the big picture. It's not only the vehicle efficiency you should take into account, but what the fuel efficiency is, meaning how much energy does it take to get that fuel into the vehicle. For instance, let me give you an example. If we have a 25 mile per gallon internal combustion engine gasoline vehicle, the fuel efficiency is 82%, meaning you lose 18% of the energy in getting it from the oil well, refined, and to the gasoline pump. Okay? Now, you multiply that by the vehicle efficiency. This is when we talk about, when we think vehicle efficiency, we talk about miles per gallon. That's a measure of the vehicle efficiency. For 25 miles per gallon internal combustion engine, it's 16%. So you multiply those two together to get the overall efficiency, 13%. That's low. That's pretty low, right? We could all agree that that's low. That means you're losing 87% of the energy that's sitting in the oil when it's in the ground. You're only getting 13% of that to the drivetrain. Okay, so you're losing the vast majority here. Let's look at some of the alternatives now. And I'll break out both the well-to-tank and tank-to-wheel efficiencies for these in a second. These numbers might differ a little bit from what Sherry showed. I'll give you a list of references, I'll give you an email address, and I'll give you a list of references if you're interested. There are different studies that have slightly different numbers, but generally these are in agreement with what Sherry said. She was using the Argonne National Laboratory number. So let me highlight a few things here. What we have is a typical gasoline vehicle, 25 miles per gallon, and then an efficient gasoline vehicle. So what's this? This, the most efficient gasoline vehicle that was mass-produced was the 1993 Honda Civic DX. So it was a small engine, 1.5 liter, 92 horsepower. So not a lot of power, but it got 51 miles per gallon, according to the Department of Energy, in combined cycle drive. That's just a regular, a 1993 car, right? So it's possible to make efficient gasoline vehicles. You have to make some sacrifices in power and size, right? It's not going to be very powerful, and this was a small vehicle. All right, what else do we have? The diesel is a VW Jetta. It gets 50 miles per gallon in combined cycle driving. The Prius, a fuel cell that was developed by Honda, a fuel cell vehicle hybrid, okay, and Sherry talked about those. That was developed by Toyota. And then we have electric vehicles, and I have two different categories. One would be a lower efficiency electric vehicle, and that's, what do I mean by low efficiency? It just depends on how you get the electricity. Okay, you can get it from an inefficient coal-fired power plant. Okay, that would be the low end. On the high end, you can get it from a natural gas-fired combined cycle power plant. Okay? The difference in efficiency is roughly, you have about 35% efficiency for a coal-fired power plant, about 60% efficiency for a natural gas combined cycle plant. So that's the difference there. And keep in mind that this would be if you're operating a plug-in hybrid vehicle in the electric mode before you've had to turn on the engine. This is the efficiency that you could expect. So just in broad terms, you look at all of these middle technologies, you get about twice the well-to-wheel efficiency of the typical vehicle. And if you have an efficient power plant generating your electricity, you get about three times the well-to-wheel efficiency. Okay? Now, let's look at how this breaks down. Okay, here's a breakdown of the well-to-tank and the tank-to-wheel efficiency. And I think I'll just move on to the well-to-wheel CO2 emissions. But again, you get so... For an electric vehicle, or this could be a plug-in hybrid vehicle operating in the electric mode, you get three times the efficiency, and the other technologies give you about twice that. Okay, now I've thrown a couple of other technologies on here, so let me show you what this is. So this is the well-to-wheel CO2 emissions. Again, I have the 25 mile per gallon vehicle. I have that efficient gasoline vehicle. I have the VW Jetta, the Prius fuel cell vehicle hybrid. Now, what about this? Ethanol-fueled typical vehicle. So this is if you're fueling with pure ethanol made from corn. That's how we get ethanol currently in this country. So corn ethanol in a vehicle, and I'll come back to look at that. Biodiesel fuel. So this is biodiesel from soy. That's how we get biodiesel in this country, from soybeans. In Europe, they get it from rapeseed. But from soy, this is if you put that fuel in this vehicle, in the VW Jetta, that's what you would get from CO2 emissions. And then I have the electric vehicles again. So, and what do I have here? I have that the California Air Resources Board 2009 standard, the 2016 standard, and again, these might go nationwide depending on what happens in Congress. You see that there are only three technologies that will meet that more stringent 2016 standard: the fuel cell vehicle hybrid, the biodiesel fueled vehicle, and electric vehicle operating from a very efficient power plant. Okay? Note this. Ethanol from corn, you only get a 12% reduction in well-to-wheel CO2 emissions. Why is that? Well, it takes a lot of energy to make the ethanol from corn. Corn is not a good energy crop. I know I could be stoned for saying that in Wisconsin, but it's the truth. It's not a good energy crop. Now, well, I'll talk about ethanol. How else could we get ethanol? You probably all know very well that you can get it, or there's a lot of work being done to get it from cellulose. And in fact, the University of Wisconsin-Madison just got a Department of Energy grant for $125 million to have a center for cellulosic ethanol research here on the Madison campus. So there's a lot of work being done on cellulose, and that's the whole wild card in terms of biofuels. That's sort of the holy grail of biofuels, would be cost-effective ethanol from cellulose.
How effective is what Brazil's doing from sugarcane?
Sugarcane is a lot better because they can use the gas, which is a byproduct of the refining process, to fuel to provide the heat for the ethanol conversion process. But sugarcane only grows in middle latitudes, so it wouldn't work very well for the U.S. But you make a good point. There are a lot of energy crops that are good energy crops. Palm oil, for instance. And we see that biodiesel from soy is a very good energy crop. All right, so here's a breakdown again. And I've put a few other things on here. So these are all the plug-in hybrid vehicle now operating from an inefficient coal-fired plant. So this is in the electric-only mode. Natural gas efficient plant, a nuclear plant, or from renewable sources. And of course, from a nuclear plant, you're not getting any CO2 emissions. From renewable sources, like solar and wind, you're not getting any renewable or any CO2 emissions. So those are really the most promising in terms of decreasing tailpipe CO2 emissions from motor vehicles. So I want to talk a little bit about those promising technologies then. The fuel cell hybrid vehicle. Okay, well, the issue there is it's incredibly costly still. All of the automakers have a program, and their fuel cell program will be a fuel cell electric hybrid. Okay, so it's a lot like the plug-in hybrid, but instead of having the internal combustion engine that you're using the internal combustion engine to recharge the battery, you're using a fuel cell. So it can be considered a range extender on an electric vehicle. But it's still too costly, and it's in the research and development phase. Biodiesel from soy. Well, that looks very promising until you realize that if we use the entire soybean crop, it would only supply 6% of our U.S. Diesel fuel demand. Okay, so again, we need a different source of biofuel. Note that ethanol, if we used our entire corn supply just to make ethanol to fuel our motor vehicles, of course something we wouldn't do, but if we did, we'd only be supplying 12% of our gasoline demand. So we need other sources of biofuel, and I mentioned from cellulose. So things like switchgrass, rice straw, wood chips, okay, waste forest products. So these kind of things have a lot of promise. The energetics are much more favorable, and it's just right now it's too costly. The technology needs to be improved to bring the cost down. So that's still in the research and development phase. Now, the electric vehicles, in the past, they haven't had enough range, and the consumers didn't want to be tied to an electrical output, so there was not really good success. You've seen you saw the movie Who Killed the Electric Car. So it's controversial whether those electric vehicles would have been a success had GM handled things differently. But anyway, if these are the issues that you need to solve from the electric vehicle, the plug-in hybrid does this, okay? It extends the range, and you don't need to plug it in if you don't want to. You could just operate in the hybrid mode. All right, so now there's a race. There's a race to come up with the first production plug-in hybrid electric vehicle. Toyota has said that in their third generation hybrid drivetrain, it's going to use lithium-ion batteries. Lithium-ion batteries are what we're going to need for the plug-in hybrid. So this opens the door to a plug-in hybrid option for the next generation of Prius. of Priuses, which is going to come out in 2009. It might be an option at first for them to get some experience with the technology. But that's the time frame we're looking at. GM is also, I would say GM and Toyota are leading the race at this point. They announced their Chevy Volt, and they hired Johnson Controls with a partnership with Saft, as well as Cobasys and A123 to develop lithium-ion batteries for the Saturn Vue plug-in hybrid that they want to launch in 2009, perhaps. It might not be around until 2010. Sherry was very skeptical of those announcements, but I think GM they really are pursuing this as a transition. From what they see, we have biofuels taking some of their vehicles as their E85 vehicles, and then they're transitioning to plug-in hybrids, and they think eventually fuel cell vehicles will be the answer. I don't know about the extra step to fuel cell vehicles, but I think they're very sincere in pursuing the plug-in hybrid option. Honda, Ford, and Chrysler are also pursuing this, and Nissan as well. I've neglected to mention Nissan. This is the Chrysler Sprinter van. They have a plug-in hybrid test fleet going for that vehicle. All right. So what you do for a plug-in hybrid, you need to increase the battery capacity by about a factor of 10. In the Prius, you have 1.3 kilowatt hours of energy capacity in the battery, in the nickel metal hydride battery. You need to get that to about 16 kilowatt hours, okay? And that gives you a 40 mile range on electric power only. It gives you a 600 mile total range on 12 gallons of fuel if you're going to drain both the battery and the engine. So you're averaging 50 miles per gallon. How does it do that? Well, one thing, some of you who know the range of your Prius might say, well, wait a minute, that math doesn't work out because you're increasing the capacity by a factor of 10, but I know my Prius can only go 2 miles before I run out of battery. I mean, my dad knows that because he ran out of gas. So, okay, so you only have 2 miles of capacity. So why doesn't the math work out? How do I get, if I'm increasing this by a factor of 10, wouldn't that just give me 20 miles? Well, the thing about the lithium-ion batteries, you can discharge it more. The nickel metal hydride battery, you can only discharge to about 60%, 65%.
That's wrong. That's absolutely wrong. Prius doesn't allow you to.
Well,
but you can discharge to 10%.
Okay, you can, but you're going to have significant impacts on the reliability.
Not true. There are RAV4 EVs routinely discharged down to 10% in California. There are 300 of them running.
Well, we can talk about it afterward, okay? But the more you discharge a nickel metal hydride battery, the greater amount of discharge, it does impact the reliability, the number of charges that it can take. That's a known fact.
This is a side point. I had 2001 Prius that ran out of gas. Generally, they controlled it that well. They over 5 miles. They had that battery discharge pretty low, so the car would barely run.
Okay, Toyota's doing it for a reason. They want the batteries to last a long time. It's not some conspiracy. So anyway, the lithium-ion battery, you can discharge a greater amount. You can discharge to 30% of its total. So that's where that extra factor of 2 comes in. All right, what about the architecture for this Chevy Volt vehicle? It is what's called a series hybrid. The Toyota Prius is what's called a complex hybrid. It can operate in series mode or it can operate in a parallel mode. But this Chevy Volt would just be a series hybrid. And you can think of that the engine being a range extender. The engine can charge the battery, okay, or the engine can go through the electric motor and deliver energy directly to the mechanical transmission. Okay, but it's always going through the electric motor. Okay, what does that allow you to do? Well, every engine, if you plot the power versus speed, and then you have these contours of fuel consumption. What it means is an engine has a sweet spot, okay, where it's going to minimize the fuel consumption. So if you're just using the engine, it's never directly tied to the mechanical transmission. So you can always operate it at this speed and this power, at the sweet spot. And that improves the efficiency considerably. Okay, so that's a great advantage to this series architecture. Okay, so let's do the math then on driving costs. So you can discharge this 16 kilowatt hour battery to 30% of its capacity. So that means you're using 11.2 kilowatt hours of electricity to travel 40 miles. At 10 cents per kilowatt hour, which is the rate that I pay in Milwaukee, the driving cost is 3 cents per mile. And the driving cost for a 25 mile per gallon vehicle at $3 a gallon, which is the current price in Milwaukee, is 12 cents per mile. Okay, so a factor of 4 less. Okay, so it is a lot cheaper to operate these plug-in hybrids in the electric-only mode. Okay, the other thing, you know, GM calls their cars flex fuel vehicles because you can fuel on gasoline or you can fuel up on E85. Well, you can think of a plug-in hybrid as being a true flex fuel vehicle because you could fuel it, you could run it in just the hybrid mode, and they're going to have an E85 platform, so you could choose a biofuel, you could choose gasoline, or you could just run it in electric-only mode, and then you're using whatever you're getting from your utility. In Wisconsin, we get most of our electricity from coal. But I know here in Madison and in Milwaukee, and most utilities now have green pricing programs where you can, for a premium, in Milwaukee it's 13% more, you pay to get all of your electricity from renewable sources of energy, mostly wind and a small amount of solar, some biogas from municipal waste facilities. But most of it's wind. It's a small amount of hydro as well. But so you see that if you're fueling on and nuclear, there's nuclear in there, nuclear, renewable, hydroelectric, all of that, then you'd have zero net CO2 emissions from your vehicle, which it would be a very nice option to have. So I'm really excited to get these plug-in hybrids on the market, and I'm optimistic that they will come by around 2010. So let's review the advantages. So you get up to a 3 times well-to-wheel efficiency and as low as a quarter of the CO2 emissions of a typical car in the plug-in hybrid if you're operating in the electric-only mode. You're powered primarily from domestic sources. The infrastructure is ready. It's relatively mature technology, and you have low-cost operation. In addition, this vehicle-to-grid idea is also an advantage of this, being able to put energy back on the grid during peak times. That'll decrease the cost of electricity for all of us. If the utilities don't have to buy from peaking plants where the price is very high, and also those peaking plants tend to be less control over the emissions. So that's another very important advantage of plug-in hybrids. Well, what are the challenges? Well, an affordable lithium-ion battery. That the battery technology isn't. I would say it's not ready. I would disagree with Sherry on that in that regard. Right now, you can get a lithium-ion battery for about $1,000 per kilowatt hour. So for that Volt vehicle, that's going to be $16,000. That's just for the battery. So that would put it out of the realm of most of us to be able to afford. So that's the most significant challenge. Oops. Let me go back. Also, battery durability and abuse tolerance is an issue, reliability and long life. What you need is 150,000 miles for 15 years if you're going to put this in a production motor vehicle. Okay, that's presents some real challenges. So now there's a race. Yes?
You were talking about Sherry. She was talking, I think, about nickel metal hydride as opposed to lithium ion. Would you disagree with her on that as well?
Yeah, lithium ion has about twice the energy density of nickel metal hydride. So you put in 16 kilowatt hours of nickel metal hydride batteries in the vehicle, that's going to be too heavy. So that's going to be a problem. None of the companies are looking at nickel metal hydride for this application. And these are the companies that are looking at it. I mentioned that GM has hired these two companies. It's a good idea. They're getting these two to compete for the contract for the Saturn View plug-in hybrid. So it's a race between these two companies for that car company. And then you see a lot of these other really large companies that are working on this. And we'll see. It's a race, and some of them have partnered with automakers, but some of them have said that they would offer it to all of the automakers. So And the thing about lithium-ion batteries, as opposed to nickel metal hydride batteries, there are a lot of different platforms for the battery. There are a lot of different chemistries that you can use, and so there is a lot of opportunity here to deal with some of these challenges. So if you're excited about plug-in hybrid vehicles, don't worry, Hollywood will take care of us. Look at Rob Lowe. Is Rob Lowe here? I know my mom wanted to meet him. I thought he might be here. So he's behind the tax breaks for the plug-in hybrids. He was in Washington recently talking to... You know, they didn't invite any of the automakers. They invited Rob Lowe. So that's interesting. So what's going to happen by the year 2020? Well, you can take this with a grain of salt, but diesel and hybrids will comprise about 50% of the market. And there's going to be a mix of mild hybrids to plug-ins, the whole range of hybrids, and there'll be different platforms, diesel, electric hybrid vehicles. And when I say hybrids, I'm not including fuel cells in there. So this is just internal combustion engine electric vehicle hybrids, along with diesels, will comprise about 50% of the market. There'll be about a fivefold increase in transportation energy from biofuels. That was what Bush announced, but I think that is a conservative amount. And again, the wild card here is ethanol from cellulose, and whether that's going to... Will we be there by 2020? I don't know. I think it'll be right around then, and then we'll really see a takeoff in biofuel vehicles. And fuel cells, it's just by 2020, it's not going to be here. It'll be a small niche market. It'll be kind of like where the hybrid market was about 5 years ago. You know, occasionally you might see a hybrid vehicle on the road. I think by 2020, maybe occasionally you'll see a fuel cell vehicle. It'll be a luxury item. I'm just like, look at me, I'm running on hydrogen. All right, well, that's all I have. So I'd like to thank you for coming. I'd like to thank the sponsors and organizers of this event. And as I said, if you're interested in the references, send me an email and I'll provide you with this list. I'd be happy to take questions. Yes?
Chris, what is the history of nickel metal hydride, and how did that come to be cost-effective?
I don't know the whole history, but the advantage that nickel metal hydride has over a lot of the other technologies is a high abuse tolerance, and that's what you need in motor vehicle applications. You need something that will take a lot of abuse and has a lot of reliability, and that's where nickel metal hydride. That's an advantage nickel metal hydride has over the lithium ion battery currently. Yes.
Why is lithium-ion technology so expensive? Is it the materials, the manufacturer? What's the limiting factor here?
Well, that's a good question. It's not the materials. Actually, the nickel metal hydride, they've been able to improve the battery, but the costs haven't gone down because the cost of nickel has gone up so much. Lithium is a much more abundant resource. I'm not sure about that. I think it's something that they'll be able to work out. Lithium ion technology, of course, we all have lithium ions in our laptops and cell phones and whatever. It's a matter of scaling them up for an automotive application where you have an environment that is much more challenging for the battery. And thermal management issues are a big issue with lithium ion batteries.
Ted Bowden spoke about that yesterday. He was very concerned about people who are piling on too many of them in tight spaces in some of these niche market cars. He's afraid they're going to have a fire at Tesla.
And that's great for mechanical engineers like me who focus on thermal energy, right? And it gives us jobs to deal with these thermal management issues. And, you know, we're losing jobs because of the electrical engineers are getting a lot of jobs in the automotive industry, but they're still going to need us for those thermal management issues. Other questions?
Yes, one question about the Saturn view. I think most of us are aware of the difference between a real hybrid and a mild hybrid. Now, are you saying that the Saturn View in 2019 came out as a full hybrid? Or are you saying it's a plug-in mild hybrid?
That's an excellent question. And my understanding is that it's not, right now the view is a mild hybrid. Meaning that it's the ratio of electrical power to gasoline power is very, very low. But my understanding is that the plug-in hybrid view, it's just going to use the view platform, but it'll be a full plug-in hybrid with a range of, I don't think it's going to be the 40-mile range. I think it might be somewhere between 20 and 30 miles is what they're shooting for.
Okay, that is a big difference because the current view mild hybrid is merely a rapid start.
Yeah, that's right.
It is not even used in the update.
All they're doing, they're just losing the vehicle platform, but they're none of the other hybrid technology. It's going to be a totally different hybrid drivetrain. Yes?
Chris, Prius owners have had difficulty with tire wear. I just replaced tires on mine, and they told me that they're so hard on tires because of the weight of the vehicle, which a lot of it is related to that. Is that true? And does the lithium-ion battery address it?
Well, and I'm not sure if that is. My best guess is that might be the reason for the rapid decay of the tires. And yeah, the lithium-ion platform would take care of that. As I said, the energy density of the battery is about twice that of the nickel metal hydride. So if you use the same capacity, and that's probably what they'll do at the beginning, is put a lithium-ion battery, but leave it as the hybrid, not use it as a plug-in hybrid. That would decrease the battery weight by a factor of two. Which is, and that's a significant portion of the weight of the overall weight of the vehicle.
Well, thank you, Chris. My pleasure.